It is that time of year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February, but each week until then we'll be re-airing some of our favorites from 2024. This week's nice replay is episode 353, The Super Powerful Beam or whatever. Code Libraries, Game Overs, originally published June 27th, 2024. So this is, there's, roundtables have two topics.
Uh-huh.
This one, there's a topic that I brought and a topic that you brought, Steven.
Yes.
My topic is fine.
Okay.
It's good enough to put in the best of.
Okay, okay.
But I picked this because of your topic, yeah. Game Overs.
Yeah, and the way I remember this topic going is I was like, hey, I don't like this thing, and I can't explain why. Help me. And we kind of just talked about that for 20 minutes or whatever, so... I think it went well. Ellen, you remember it going well?
I don't remember a lot of, like, I don't remember a lot of what we didn't, like, what we actually said in past episodes, which is why I like nice replays so much. And so I assume that it went well because, yeah, why wouldn't it? And also, you can tell kind of how well an episode went by how awesome the title is.
That's
and this
true.
Is not one of the best titles.
This is a very good title.
It's just a
proxy. So I'm sure... There will be a lot of like useful game dev meat on the bones of this episode, but the number one reason I am listening to it again is so I can hear where that phrase comes from.
Well, listener, you can listen momentarily and find out for yourself. And the show will be back with new episodes at the end of February. But while you wait, you can get these nice replays and all our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Game's over. Game's overs. So if everyone's ready, let's start.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can...
You should just call that two bads.
Two bads.
Two bads.
I guess that's a Mario thing, huh? Yeah.
Whatever. Don't quite have that impression down.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Mark, you got a new car. We talked about it a little bit last time, but...
Yeah, I'm the proud owner of a dinky little wagon, a little smart car, which I've replaced from the previous little smart car I had. Because I'm nothing if not stubborn. listeners who heard a recent episode, I talked about the engine broke and then I got an EV replacement that's the same car. And one of the things I think I talked about in that is that one of the features of the little smart cars when they were at their most popular in the middle of the 2010s was that you could replace all the panels on them with other colors. They kind of thought they would sell like them like phone cases, like, you know. Tired of the yellow one, get the orange one or whatever. I don't think in practice very few people did it. They would, you know, it meant that if you got like a scratch or something, you could replace it.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool. I don't know how often that happened. But in my case, I just liked the color of my old car. And so I just wanted to put it on the new car.
Yeah.
And so I did that over Memorial Day weekend. And it went pretty good. It took me like 2 full days.
Okay.
My fingers hurt like crazy. They still kind of hurt, and it's been like over a week later.
Yeah.
Lots of like, you know, reaching and grabbing. And the thing is, it's like there are these plastic panels held together mostly by plastic clips.
Oh.
Just it did not feel automotive in any really sense.
Yeah.
But
that's funny.
There was some rewiring involved. And also I had to go and see like because the old car is essentially scrap, I had to like I had to because it was my only opportunity to like pick the best components from both.
Oh, sure.
Because that was the other thing about this new car that I got is I had it shipped in from Virginia from a dealer there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got the report about the mechanics, but I didn't really care about the cosmetics. Like, was it because I was going to be discarding all these old panels? Mm-hmm. Turns out I'm really glad. I was kind of the perfect customer for this car because it arrived and, like, the hood, like, was missing the clips that hold it on. So, like, it was on the back of a flatbed truck across the country, so it got really dirty. So we went through Dale and I went through a car wash before we dismantled all the panels.
Sure.
And thinking like, well, this is kind of a waste of cleaning a car, but
yeah.
But in the car wash, the hood like flew off.
Oh my goodness!
And like we were gonna like drive over, and it was like a whole like panicky thing.
Oh yeah!
And we checked it out later, like the parts that are supposed to hold the hood on were just missing.
Oh.
Like you couldn't, it wouldn't be safe to drive it on the highway.
Yeah.
And like, great, I was going to replace it anyway, but like someone sold me that car.
Right. If you didn't, oh my goodness. Wow.
So just very weird. Also made me think like, oh, I wonder that's because one of the reasons I got it was because of a really good price.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, oh, I bet the people who went for that showroom and like got a good look at it
mm-hmm.
were like, I can't, I'm not going to buy this car.
Yeah.
So I was the perfect customer for it. I mean, if I had known about that, I still would have bought the car.
Yeah.
Because the whole point was to replace the thing. So I did. It looks just like my 2011, even though it's a 2015. I did have to take a handsaw and make some notches
Whoa.
In some of the panels.
Okay.
Now that sounds terrible.
Yes, it does.
But it's because on the EV version of this car, the battery is on the undercarriage, and so it kind of extrudes about an inch and a half below the floorboard.
Oh.
And it ends thus there's these two tiny little panels on the side. The details are not interesting, but the ones on my original car didn't have the notch that accounted for that little extruded piece like the one on my new one did.
Yeah.
And that surprised me because one of the things I was needed to be sure of before I started on this adventure was that all these things were interchangeable. I'm like, yeah, but this is the EV version. Is it the same? And I was assured by multiple websites
that it was
that all these are exactly the same. Like they changed some things here and there, but all the connection points are identical. And so when I discovered that, I was like, oh no, what else is not working? And it was the only incompatibility.
Okay. Well,
so I made a template from the original one, which was very difficult because there was nowhere to lay the thing down flat. Again, these details are not interesting, but the point I'm trying to make is that I was very handy over Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah.
I used a razor blade
to
like cut the notches out of a panel of a car. Like it's just the weirdest experience. And all that is on the underside. So like I tried to make it nice, but I didn't have to make it perfect.
Yeah.
Put it all back together, which was a whole separate ordeal from taking it apart because there's like clips.
Right.
And things, and like you don't want to, it's like plastic. Like,
yeah, you don't want to.
So there was lots anything. Of, it would have gone a lot faster if I was more daring, but it was like, if I make one mistake, and then I got to get out the super glue.
It's a whole thing. Yeah.
That was kind of fun.
Cool.
Yeah. But now I got my little car back, and it's an EV, and it just feels like nothing has changed. It's like a huge waste of time and money. Like, and it's summertime. I'm going to be biking everywhere. Just what a.
Well, you're prepared for the winter.
Everything's so futile in this life.
I suppose. Gosh.
That got dark.
Had a great time, though.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Ellen, you recently hired someone, right?
And did.
You want to talk about that song?
Yeah, I do. I don't want to call out her name specifically on the podcast because I haven't asked her permission to do that.
Okay.
But hopefully we have her on the show sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be cool. And yeah, she's local to the Twin Cities, which is awesome.
Cool.
And she's a game designer. So we hired her to replace me on the custom development team. And yeah, she's great. She's fantastic.
Awesome.
And it's been really nice because like in my managerial role right now, I don't do a lot of design work and I miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I, you know, still meeting with her a couple times a week. And so we do some of that together and
living vicariously through her. Right?
You're
living vicariously through her.
Exactly.
Which means it's got to be someone you like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Beyond the normal reasons. Yeah. I do remember when you were doing interviews, you were like, this lady's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, So I'm glad that all that worked out because that was a big stress is feeling that position.
Yeah. Yeah.
And dealing with not having it filled for a good long while, right?
Yeah. Yeah, everyone was kind of, there's a lot of work that was languishing untouched. And now it's been picking up steam with great speed.
Yeah, that's great.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
Cool.
Are we done with news, Steven?
Yeah, we're done with news.
You have nothing to say?
No more news.
Don't curious, yet, but I might later.
Not later in the show.
Not later in the show. Sorry. A future recording.
Stay tuned to future broadcasts for some news from Steve.
And it'll be more exciting than the Spirit Island spirit that I was working on that I talked about last time.
All right. I've got a topic this week. It's code libraries.
Okay.
Now, I have occasionally talked about things like this and adjacent to this.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about making your own tools and about working with frameworks.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of just taking another crack at it because I'm dealing with it in a couple of different ways right now. One is that on Dream Settler, and I've talked about this on the show before, I've been building a set of tools that are actually a lot of them came from Widget Satchel.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah.
Maybe about half of them did. The other half are new. Mm-hmm. But they've been evolving from project to project. And so I've been taking that as an opportunity to make that something I can package and not only just use on future projects, but actually sell as part of the Unity Asset Store thing.
Yeah.
And so the Unity drama is something that's I'm going to have to be thinking about if I'm going to be part of that ecosystem as a tool provider.
Yeah.
So that's a whole separate topic. And I've talked a little bit about that in a previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also, because I'm working on two big Unity projects right now, which we talked about in a recent episode, those tools, I'm not using the same ones on both, but the ones I am are also evolving very fast.
Right, yeah.
And I am now a user of the tools rather than just a developer of the tools.
Right, okay.
Because between the two projects, I need to make sure that they're synced.
Yeah.
If I make some changes in one project, I need to bring it over to the other. And that's not dissimilar from when you sort of hack away at the tools you download or make adjustments or changes.
Yeah.
I feel a lot more like a customer of these tools
that
I've been building rather than a creator, even though I also still feel like that. And then on top of that, I'm also, as starting a big new Unity project, I'm now back in the market for a bunch of libraries.
Yeah.
Things I need for this project that I don't need for Dream Settler.
Okay.
And so a lot more browsing GitHub and the Unity Asset Store and wherever other place I can find C# code to do the thing I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Getting much more familiar with the .NET libraries that I sort of felt I needed to know, but that's just because it was very project specific.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So it's just been every angle of this has been on my mind. And so one of the things that I want to talk about now is just as a developer, your relationship to code that isn't yours.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
Both literally and then also philosophically.
Okay.
In a sense.
Cool.
We'll see how far we get on the first half before we talk at all about the second.
Okay.
But the first thing is to kind of just define some terms, and these are fuzzy, and I honestly could care less about them being less fuzzy than this, but it is, at least for this topic, this is the definitions we'll use.
Okay.
So you're talking about a game engine.
Like Unity,
or there's other things. I think a lot of people think of a game engine as a piece of software, like an editor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually not what an engine is generally. But when you're using Unity, that's kind of what it feels like, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I would say an engine does everything. Right?
Okay.
You have, you still got to write your ifs and your fors.
Right.
You got to write some code, but the APIs you use are provided entirely by the engine.
Right.
Right. That's or rather, you can make something with only that. Right. I think almost no one does. But that, I think, qualifies as an engine when you can just get that and you can ship something.
Yeah.
Right? A framework, I think that some people use that interchangeably with an engine, and I think that's perfectly fair, especially when you're talking about things that are not games.
Mm-hmm.
But a framework is essentially many things working in concert.
Oh.
So when you think about a library, and that's the next definition, which is it does a thing.
Okay.
This is a library to decode this file format.
Sure.
This is a library that helps me manage this animation curve or whatever.
Okay.
That's a code library, right?
Okay.
Some people call them plugins. I've resisted that for a very long time because to me, a plugin is something different.
Mm.
But I think that's a perfectly fine definition, particularly in the Unity world. It's almost enmeshed in how Unity project structures are put together.
Yeah.
The term plugin for this,
sure.
Even though it can be kind of ambiguous. And so if you feel that ambiguity, know that it's fine that you feel that. It's not that you didn't learn something, it's that it's ambiguous.
Okay.
Anyways, but I'm going to be using the term library. That's what I've always used.
Okay.
And that's just, it's a thing that does a thing, right?
All right, thing that does a thing. Okay.
And the thing about it is that that is as far as the definition can go, right? Because if the code does two things, but they're related, or it does two things in service of one thing, then fine, it's still a code library.
Mm.
But as soon as it starts to do more things, you can start calling it a framework. Like, this is a framework for handling images. So it has a way to flip UVs. It has a way to, interpret texture scaling. And they're all different tools, but they're part of a same kind of aim or category.
Yeah.
You'd call that a framework.
Okay.
Right? But then then you're like, well, once you have scene management and things that need to make a full game, or you're talking about another type of software, everything that software needs,
mm-hmm.
then you're talking about an engine.
Yeah.
The barriers between these definitions are very permeable, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
But I think when you don't think about this stuff, you tend to do things like download a C# file you found on GitHub, make a couple of tweaks, stick it in a folder in your project, and now it's your code.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fine, frankly. Mm. There's nothing actually wrong with that. I mean, puts my teeth on edge, the sort of organizational element of it.
Oh, sure.
But it does make you feel you want to have a relationship with code that isn't yours in a project so that you have a better understanding, especially as a project gets bigger, what choices you've made and what choices you've outsourced others to make.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you outsource those choices to others, you do that very deliberately. I am not going to make decisions about this. So that later on, when you start feeling like that doesn't seem like the right choice, if you just have a bunch of code pasted into other scripts of yours or just in a folder somewhere in your project, you can start to kind of forget that, like, oh, that decision wasn't mine.
Right.
And so when I change it, I'm now making my own decision versus like hacking at someone else's or rejecting that because it doesn't work for me anymore or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think the bigger your project gets, the easier it can be to kind of just like treat all that as one big blob. And that generally happens when you talk about smaller pieces of code that you pull from other places.
Yeah.
Code you copy and paste from Stack Overflow or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of that, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I paste something in, I tend to then rewrite it immediately.
Oh, no, I don't do that.
One, for my own code style, but yeah. Also to like get an understanding of how it works and make sure I'm like getting rid of the stuff I don't need.
Oh, I absolutely don't do that. Sorry.
I make it mine.
Yeah.
Or I make it a library.
Okay.
And I put it in a libraries folder.
So you know it's not
yours. Identify where it came from.
Yeah.
Like in a comment or, and these are all just sort of like, you know, anal retentive organization stuff, but it really, really helps later on when I start working with things and I'm like, oh, this isn't a C# or a .NET API. This isn't a Unity API. This is that thing I found on Stack Overflow 2 years ago.
Yeah.
That I've been using a lot.
Yeah.
And then you'll because sometimes you'll be like, oh, there's actually a better solution out there, or oh, the engine has updated and now does this function.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can take it out because I don't need it anymore. But if it's enmeshed in my code, uses my naming conventions and has like references to code within its own methods, because it can't be used in any other project. It's like, it has to be in mine.
Yeah.
Then suddenly if I find a better way to do that function, I have to unwind it from my project.
Sure.
Right. So yeah. I guess I got on the philosophical bar early.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, Stephen, and yeah. Ellen, you can weigh in on this too, if you have any angle on it. Like your relationship with code that isn't yours, stuff that you didn't write that needs to be put into.
Yeah. This is a good question. I feel nervous about it.
Yeah.
Because it's not my code. So like if I don't understand how it works, then it's like I'm putting this thing in here and I'm hoping that it works okay.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like it's part of it's like kind of the nature of the beast with respect to programming.
Mm-hmm.
And that like, cause like, sometimes you don't want to spend the 10 hours or whatever it takes to come up with your own solution when you could just find somebody else's solution to the thing.
Yeah. Even on a small project,
yeah.
If you write more than 50% of it, then like you've probably wasted a little bit of your time.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I don't do the due diligence that you do, which is maybe, to my detriment. In that, like, I fully understand how this code works. I get a general understanding of how the code works for the most part.
Yeah.
And, like, if I have any issues later, then I get more understanding as I need to.
Right.
But I don't, like, do all of... I don't dive into it right away because, I don't know, I don't have time for that.
Well, it's important to, like, recognize, like,
yeah.
Like, this works, it's fine, I know the ins and outs, okay.
I just, yeah, if as long as you know the gist of it, then, like, you don't want, like, you know, code you completely don't understand in your game, because that's problematic. But I don't know, I've also, you know, worked with other coders on things and I don't know how their code particularly works, so it's like kind of the same principle.
Yes. And actually I will say that there I do draw a line.
Okay.
Because on Dream Settler I am working with
right.
another developer, and we're about 50-50 on the actual lines of code that are in the project.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to take ownership of systems,
yeah,
so we tend not to be in each other's way. And we're in constant communication when we do need to be in each other's way.
Right.
And so that's worked out really well, I think. But we also take ownership of the whole project, the two of us, as the programmers on it.
Sure.
And even if parts of it I didn't write, like, I still own it. So
okay.
I can change it. And the parts that he didn't write, that I wrote, he owns that, so he can change it, right? So we make those decisions together. But like we don't find a need to, we separate things into their own systems for our own convenience, and generally we're out of each other's way a lot because we sort of work on different systems.
Yeah.
But we definitely don't treat that the same way we treat code that came from somewhere else outside the project.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I don't either, I suppose.
That's, but there's like a diligence to like being familiar with the code you didn't write that's on your team.
Yeah.
And there's a scale issue there, right?
Mm.
Like, there's only so much you can do of that.
Mm.
But if you do expect to dip your toes into a system you didn't write on your team,
yeah,
I think there is a little bit of, like, sit down, read the code before you start making the one tweak you need to make.
Yeah.
Understand that, like, oh, actually, I don't need that variable because I can get an access to that from it because it's a member of some other variable. So I don't need to overcomplicate things. And that was the way he designed it. And so I'm going to follow along and not, you know, that sort of thing. And that only comes with the comprehension. Whereas with a piece of outside code, I still do that, but then I'm also much more cavalier about like, I'm gonna do it different.
Right? Sure. Yeah.
So there's kind of the acting in one mind, and it does come down to the next question I have for you, which is like, where do you put this stuff? Like if you download a gist on GitHub or a whole project or a Unity asset or copy paste something for Stack Overflow, do you have a way to where it literally lives in your project?
Good question. No, I think it just, I don't have a specific organizational strategy for it. I think I tend to just like, if it's like a bit of code, I just copy paste it where it needs to go.
Yeah.
If it's a whole script, then I put it where it makes sense to put it. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm not like, I feel like I'm not like typically put, well, no, I guess I am like adding a bunch of random things in there, like ways to sort lists or whatever.
Oh, sure. That's the kind of thing you can just live in one of your own methods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like those kinds of things. Yeah. I'll just throw it in a method.
Because that's essentially, you just need to know exactly how to do an exact specific thing.
Yeah.
So it's as if you wrote it. Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you there. Yeah. I guess it's important to know that there is a line below which it is your code anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the distinction doesn't matter as much. But yeah, if it's like if it's a separate script, then I guess I don't bother like putting it separately. I will comment it. Yeah, I know, shocking, right? Me commenting. to make sure that like I'm aware that like this has particular idiosyncrasies or what have you. Yeah. But like I won't necessarily put it in a separate location. Mm-hmm. Cause I don't know. I for the most part understand how it works. Cause frankly, I mean, like if I come back to code 2 months later, it's as though I didn't write it anyways. So it kind of doesn't matter as much, at least to me. That's how I see it, sort of.
Nice games that loves our feedback. Even the comment is code.
I mean, actually, this is gonna sound worse, but I feel like libraries have better comments and code than my own. So that's probably worse too. Yeah. But yeah, I guess I don't really make that distinction between the two different things because I feel like for the most part, as long as I have a general understanding of how it works and like there's enough comments where if I come back to it or it's clear enough, the code, where I come back to it, I can understand what it does after looking through it, then I don't think I need to separate it.
Okay.
But if there's anything more complicated than that, I guess if you're talking about like frameworks or such, then like those are separated because they separated them themselves.
Right. Generally speaking. Sort of they bring their own little structure to it that you don't want to supersede.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm. All right. Well, I will say I don't love it, but like
Well, you don't work for Future Club, so.
No. But like I'll allow it.
Okay,
like,
cool.
Like that's kind of the thing is, I mean, there's no wrong way to do anything. Like, frankly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly no right way.
Mm.
I was just trying to, you said you'll allow it. I was trying to imagine what would happen if you said you wouldn't. Like, you're going to roll up to the Future Club Discord and be like, I need to do a code review. Yeah. And everyone's like,
code audit.
Trust me, I need to do a code review.
Steven's not allowed to do this anymore. So if you see him doing it on the playground, just give me a call. And, I'll come and pick him up.
Oh my gosh.
And then he'll be grounded.
I'll just at home.
Yeah.
Oh, hilarious.
All right. I do want to address some of the utility of being a little bit more deliberate about that.
Sure, yeah.
But, Ellen, I want to ask you, because I think one of the other things about code that isn't yours is that that can exist at the organizational level, right? Not just like frameworks you license or whatever, but like you've talked about the sort of the platform that a lot of the products at your company operates on. That's its own sort of library that each project sort of lives into. Does your company have like a whatever visibility you could provide, any kind of like a process for those types of things or dealing with outside libraries, especially as like something that is in JavaScript, it's gotta be 75% frameworks and libraries and stuff, right?
Yeah, I can give you a little bit. First of all of the code is not my code because I don't do programming. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so the game product we have, it's all web-based. I think all the products we have are web-based. One of our products also has a desktop version.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one product also might have an app version, or at least has an app element to the overall system.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I mean, they're not all pulling from the same code base, right? Because the way that the company in its current form came together was a lot of different smaller companies merged.
Yeah.
They glommed. That'll come back later. glom. Anyway. Sorry. Glom. Anyway. Yeah. So all of those products were developed separately by completely different organizations.
Right. Right.
And there definitely is ongoing work to create kind of a uniform experience, but that's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
I can't speak to like how much of the code base is similar or not. I know like there's working on getting the UX more uniform. They're working on getting things like slurped up into one big product.
Yeah.
Like where they're a lot more of like an Adobe kind of sort of thing where you have like all the stuff you could possibly think about. You have a tool for that. You have a tool for that, but we're not quite there yet. So when it comes to the game product, yeah, I mean, I know that they used Phaser, mm-hmm. the Phaser yeah. engine for some of the games, not all of them though. I think the ones that are a little more physics based, they use Phaser for.
Yeah.
Sure.
Other than that though, no, I really don't. I don't know. I know lots. There's going to be a lot of JavaScript stuff.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but. But yeah, yeah. I mean, you actually like pivot to a really interesting aspect of this, which is that when you have, and again, like code libraries, like I'm thinking about this a lot because a lot of the code libraries I'm working with is code I wrote.
Yeah.
So when I say like mine, I'm kind of referring to the project, uh-huh. you know, like this is specific to this thing. And you can even get granular and say like, I'm building a system inside. So in Dream Settler, we have mini games.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm building a mini game that like I'm desperate to tell people about, but it's really neat. Mm-hmm. And but it has its own little universe. It doesn't really interact with much else other right. than the sort of desktop window APIs that we wrote, the sort of like fake OS we have.
Blah, blah, yeah. Blah.
So what I've done is I've put all that stuff in its own namespace. Like that stuff belongs to that project. Anything that the Dream Settler OS needs is essentially a library to that game. And so yeah, so there's not really like a lot of it's contextual,
yeah,
right. And so, I think the point I think that the pivot I'm hearing from what Ellen's describing how her company works is that there's all these different pieces, and a lot of them do the same sort of thing. So, like putting them together is something that you will definitely do just as a one person programmer pretty frequently when you you bring in, especially when it comes to UI, when you're like, I need to solve this problem. Oh, I need to solve this sort of similar problem, and then suddenly you have two pieces of code that you didn't write that do almost similar things and some overlap.
Oh.
Or you'll have like a utilities class with like seven different copies
yep.
of the same method because you brought them in when you needed it to be part of something larger that you needed.
Yeah.
And so there's like, there is, that is a big part of your relationship with code that isn't yours, is like synthesizing it into either its own thing or into your code.
Yeah.
Right? So like, here's some function, and this, I mean, you're working with open source stuff, you're getting things off of GitHub,
yeah.
like you have the rights to that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
To check your license to make sure that you want to make sure that like, you know, if you don't make substantial changes, that all that stuff is in place. But if you're not distributing your own code, right, then actually those notices don't necessarily apply.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other conversation. I think we have an episode on licensing. But yeah. Definitely something to keep in mind. But when you take a bunch of different code that isn't yours, there is a job to turn it into code that is yours. And I think it can be really tempting to just file off the duplicate edges of both pieces of things and then just kind of like leave them alone. But then you've hacked two pieces of somebody else's code.
Sure.
Right? So every situation is different.
Uh-huh.
But you kind of get what I'm driving at?
It's
definitely a process. And I mean, the way Ellen described it is like, I totally understand why that takes a while.
Yeah. Well, I'm relating to it in that every code that I wrote 2 months ago is not my code, right?
Right.
So if I've written something for a previous game or something, or a prototype or what have you,
mm-hmm.
And I'm working on something now, and I'm like, this is pretty similar, I can basically just copy paste this and, you know, change a few things, values, so that it makes more sense for this project, and it'll work okay. I've done that plenty of times.
Yeah.
But I'm recognizing like the issues that you're having. We're like, I don't really think about how the specifics of what I'm working on currently will apply to this code that I wrote a year ago or whatever, because right. I don't remember everything I wrote about it. And I didn't look at the code. Like, this is like, I was assigned to do this task, Steven. And I'm like, okay, I can do this task, especially since I did it a year ago. Right. So I'll just copy paste this code, put it in the thing, and then change the values or whatever that I need to. But it's more difficult than that because, like, there are specifics about this project that the other project did have or didn't have.
Yeah.
And so I have to, so yeah, I'll have to change more about the code. And after a while, you're like recognizing that like half of the crap that you wrote for the game or half the stuff that you wrote for this thing before doesn't make any sense anymore. So you comment that stuff out, you remove it. And then you'll write in a whole new set that like makes more sense for it, like you're describing,
yeah,
basically. So then it ends up becoming current Steven's code.
Yeah.
Steven's code that actually remembers what it does. So yeah, I definitely, I'm recognizing like that specificity because like I will do that for code that I have done in the past. I don't tend to do that as much for like new code that I've gotten from Stack Overflow or what have you.
Yeah.
Because like I don't need to. A lot of the times when I'm looking up stuff for that, I'm looking for a specific solution and I don't need to bother with it.
Yeah.
With changing too much. If I need more specifics of it, then I'll like look up examples that other people have done and then like try to emulate that as best I can. Mm-hmm. or copy paste and do what you were talking about, yeah, where like you'll literally change it so it works for what you're doing or so that you understand it better.
Yeah, yeah. All yeah. you needed to know is honestly just like what was the name of the yeah. method you needed. Like so it's, you know, that's not somebody else's code.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's somebody else's help.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, 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 yeah. I think you're talking about that idea of like, this is a thing I wrote a while ago. I'm going to copy paste it mm-hmm. to do something similar with some other part of the project. This is maybe the last thing I want to talk about in this section, which is when you turn your own code into library code.
Yeah.
Even if you don't intend to use it in another project.
Yeah.
And I think that can be something that feels really stupid,
mm-hmm.
but I find a lot of value in it because sure. it makes the next time you need it like so much faster.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
when it's 2 months later and you forgot everything you did
mm-hmm.
and you need to do this again, you're
yeah.
digging around your own APIs, you realize like, oh, okay, I could just do this. I don't need to customize it.
Yeah.
I've definitely seen the benefit of that a lot. I think
yeah.
there's definitely a risk of over-engineering things, right? Sometimes just, you're never going to need to build it more than once, so just build it once. But when you find yourself building it two or three times, you think about just, you know, make genericizing it. Even if it's specific to your project,
yeah.
That's, you don't need to make it something you could sell or like give to other people, but you might want to think about organizing it in your project in a way that implies that it is a tool within your project rather than part of your game code. Right.
Yeah.
And these are all very fuzzy. You decide how you want to define these things, but there's a lot of people use a utilities folder for this.
Right.
I tend to take those things and just put them alongside other third-party code, but I just put it in my own subfolder that belongs to me.
Oh, okay.
I like to think of it as code libraries because one, it reduces the amount of code that lives in like the scripts folder.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
and the amount of code I need to like dig through when I need to do something specific, especially when you solve a problem.
Right.
It's solved.
Yeah.
I like to get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I, yeah. I
you
get
know,
that.
So I think I the, that. I mean, a lot of times the lessons of my topics tend to be like organize your stuff.
Because yeah.
I definitely find
that, not a bad lesson,
because that does it makes it is a huge benefit. And sometimes and it doesn't matter how you do it, but like having a system you stick to can just speed you up so quickly.
Yeah,
because you kind of know where to find it, where to look for it, even yeah. if you don't, and you never have to memorize things exactly. But I think very frequently, I think that's the sort of maybe unexpected lesson is like sometimes your code, you can turn it into your own code library that is maybe never leaves your project. Of course, there's the obvious benefit of being able to then copy it into a new project. Love that.
Yeah.
That's not new advice. People have heard that before.
Right.
But I think sometimes you can maybe be a little quicker to doing that because you start to think like, this is utility code. This is just getting me where I need to get my implementing design and thinking about how things are actually going to be shown and, you know, the sort of like closer to the player experience of the code I'm writing. That should be the stuff I see the most.
Yeah.
And so hiding away the stuff that is just does what it needs to do in three places.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's just literally put it in a folder somewhere, like yeah. away from everything else.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a little bit of my advice. Just like all these sorts of things, like think about it a little bit more so that you can ultimately think about it all a little less.
Yeah, because, you know, you'll spend the 5 minutes now, but then you won't have to spend the 15 minutes later trying to figure it out later. So,
but it's a discipline. Like, it's annoying to do until you've done it a lot, and then it can be really like, it can be like scratching an itch, you know?
Haven't gotten that far yet.
Glam.
Yes.
She does it a little different each time.
I know. It's fun.
Collect them all.
Just like the game. Just like the game.
Just like the game. Absolutely. So we've made a game together as Nice Games Club. It's called Glam.
Yeah.
It's a romp of rewording regular remarks. I said that right, I think.
Uh-huh. Inflection was a little bit weird, but you got all the words right.
Yeah. We made it during the show. We worked on it as a Nice Games Jam, and we worked on it a bunch after that and got it published. You can get it today. You can go to nicegames.club/glom and check out all of the fancy details. It's a very fun party game, but there's a lot of details on the website as well. We've gone over plenty of times on the show, but I'm just highlighting the website because it's got a video. Got details on what like you can get, where you can get it from. It also links to the episode where we worked on it. So
yeah, because here's the thing, Steven. In the middle of the show, during this part you're listening to now, dear listener,
right.
We tend to talk about the show.
Yes,
we ask things of you. We make pitches, and that's, you know, you know what's going on.
Right.
But Glom is a little different. Mm-hmm. It's really we're this is an ad for a thing we made.
Yeah,
and
it is.
It's related to the show.
Yeah,
but we have to recognize that like what we're asking people to do is like go to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And buy a copy of Glom.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because you love the show so much, although, you know, however, whatever you want to justify it to yourself, but because it's a really cool game you will have a lot of fun with, like independent of your feelings on the show.
Yeah.
And then, you can listen to the episode where we created it to get a little bit behind the scenes, and that's cool. But I always have to, it's a little different from what we normally ask of people.
That's true.
But as is the spirit of all of these, we're open with our audience. And we're doing this ad for our own thing, but like, it's still one of the best things I think I've ever made. And getting to make it with you guys was so made it that much better.
Aww.
And getting to talk about it here on the show, where we own the ad space, has been also great.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, dear listener, if you want to, you know, again, if you love the show, if you love us, buy a copy of Glom. But you know what? You don't need to love us or love the show. Glom is amazing. You will have a good time with your friends.
Mm.
You know you want to buy another game. You're always going to want to buy another game. Yeah. We're giving you a good reason to buy another game.
It's true.
You know who you are.
Nicegames.club/Glom. All right. I have a topic. I feel like I could be really cute about this topic because it's just game overs and I could be like, game over.
All right, go ahead.
No, I don't want to. I was going to be like, I'm not doing that. I'm resisting the urge, Mark.
Uh-huh. I mean, he mentioned it. It feels like I was leading up to something.
Yeah, no, I'm not doing it. I'm sorry.
Way to disappoint the audience.
I can't go.
Wait, hold on. Ellen, can you be real cute about it real quick? Or
nope.
All right.
Do you want to try, Mark?
Not my job.
I thought so. All right, my topic. all right, game overs. So this is, you know, when you run out of health or you did a thing wrong or you're out of companions.
You're going a little fast. Let me get my notebook.
Okay. Basically, the game says game over, start again, do it differently this time.
I'm interrupting you a lot, but like, I really like that. Do it differently next time.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting angle to it that I don't, I mean, it's implicit, but I don't know that I've ever heard it expressed that way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Am I just
No. This is great because like, this is kind of what I want to talk about. Okay. So, I'm going to ahead of where I was going to go with this, but that's fine. I have had a frustration with game overs that like the past few years.
Yeah.
And it's like game overs have not really changed that much. Mm-hmm. It's just the thing that I've like started recognizing that I have an issue with respect to game overs. In that I think that like they kind of like destroy is not the right word. They mess with like the pacing of like a narrative or a gameplay flow in a way that like is very frustrating for me.
And you've tried to get good, and that hasn't helped.
This is the issue I'm having, because like this is just an issue I have with like Game Overs in general. But there's a purpose for Game Overs. They're valuable, and I understand that, and I understand and recognize that. Like Game Overs help players understand how the game works. They tell you when you've done something wrong and when you've done something right. If you don't get a game over, you did it right, you know. And they like sometimes they're like little fun Easter eggy things too, because sometimes you like get a game over in a fun way, and it's like the game acknowledges, haha, you died, but it's funny, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Those are neat and interesting and cool. But what I have an issue with is like, I think oftentimes game overs are almost a little patronizing, mm-hmm. in that I think that like us as developers are telling the player, you've done this thing wrong. Even though the player like recognizes this at this point, especially if they've got like a ton of game overs, but like the issue is I guess like a player maybe doesn't understand why they're getting game overs, and that's the problem. That's a separate issue. But I think it just can like, I'm having a hard time describing it, because it's like sort of a half considered issue, because like
Can I ask a question?
Ellen. Save me from myself.
Well, so like. That's interesting. Like, I think I liked what Mark said in that, like, the idea to that it's game over and you need to try something differently is kind of implied.
Right.
But I also hear what you're saying, and that it can kind of sometimes be like the tone of a game over is really, like, really, and the experience of it can really change whether I'm like the mindset I have as I'm trying something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? That's true.
Right. Sometimes so, like, it's just no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not as fun.
Yeah.
As try again.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think it like game overs are intentionally meant to punish players for doing things that the developer does not want them to do. But in games where like that freedom expression is important, that choice expression is important, those kinds of game overs feel almost tacked on in a way that seems silly.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, like this is an issue that like I think happens with a ton of games. Like I'm thinking about like how Baldur's Gate 3 is, where it has a bunch of different endings, but you can also get party wiped in like a random combat, right?
Uh-huh.
And then you die and you get a game over and you have to reload to a previous save. And I think in those instances, I feel like I want the game to tell me, well, you died and that was your story and this is the end of the game, and now you need to start from the beginning if you want a newer experience or different experience. Yeah. But I can't reasonably ask players every time they play a game to like not to start over every time they get a game over.
Yeah.
You can ask that of players if that's what they're looking for, and that's why honor mode exists or whatever. Because that has permadeath in Baldur's Gate 3 and other games like that. And so then they're opting into that kind of experience. But like if I wanted players to have that, I wanted all of my players to have that experience. That's a very difficult thing to ask a lot of players to have, because like it's not. When you're playing through a thing and you only get through halfway of the game and then the game ends and you have to start over, it feels like you wasted your time and you don't want to like spend all this effort to get back to the halfway point. So basically, I feel like I'm the only person who like has this issue. I think I don't know if other people are experiencing this or like feel frustrated with it.
You've said this before, but
you
have this aspiration for what a game over is, was that a game over would be a legitimate ending.
Yes.
And I think you're coming up against the fact that no game on planet Earth treats a game over that way.
Exactly.
And so I think you might be expecting a little bit too much.
Yeah, I am.
existing game overs.
And that's what that's the problem is, like, I am expecting.
You're maybe not realizing how much else needs to change for that to be a legitimate type of ending.
Yeah, and that's part of why I'm bringing up this topic, is because y'all can help me figure that out. Yeah, it's a call to action.
Yeah, yeah.
Listeners
this
can help me,
too.
This
is a new segment called Steven Berates the Game Industry.
But I think if you're talking about like games that have tests of skill,
yes,
then a game over really is a try again.
Yeah.
But if a game over is meant to be a sort of like natural conclusion,
yeah,
then it really can't be a test of skill.
Yeah.
Unless the context is do a training sequence with a bunch of try agains.
Yeah.
And then go and do the thing. Whereas if you fail, the game really does end. Over.
Yeah.
But then you do that more than once or twice in a game, and then suddenly it becomes a conceit.
Right.
You know.
We're using this term game over because it's used in different ways.
Yeah.
But really what I'm hearing is there's actually two kind of ways that it is used, and they're really different things, perhaps, and deserve a different name.
Okay.
One of them is, like, the game is over because you have reached a natural conclusion to the narrative. The game is over.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, you didn't necessarily fail. This is just the end. Like, you didn't fail within the game system. You didn't test the boundary of some rule and come up against the edge.
Right.
You just followed the path until it ended.
Right. This is and the ending of the game. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've concluded the narrative or what have you.
Yeah. Like a narrative ending. And then there's also like, okay, you are testing the game system and you did an action that results in the like lack of success criteria, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's like, is the ending a failure ending or is it like a just a conclusion ending? I guess is how I'm thinking about it. And sometimes you see game over used in the same, in both ways. Sometimes even in the same, I guess maybe not in the same game, but like across different games, you see the term game over being used in potentially both ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I appreciate that you asked that, Ellen. I can clarify. What I'm talking about specifically is not the situation where you've literally gotten to the end and you found Princess Peach, and Princess Peach is not another castle. This is the castle. I'm not talking about those kinds of endings. I'm talking about when Mario's fallen into a pit and you lose a life and you lose all your lives. And then it says game over or too bad, like in 3D Mario's and things like that.
Right. But you're not necessarily making a distinction between Mario losing a life and Mario losing all of his lives.
Yeah, I'm not making that's a fair point. I'm not making a distinction between those two. Those are effectively the same for the purposes of this discussion.
Yeah. Game over tends to be, at least in the sort of arcade and classic console sense, when you run out of lives and you need to continue.
Right.
But you're just talking about like you failed, it's time to start over. Or whatever.
Yeah.
So a much broader. So.
And I think I could try to help y'all understand like my difficulties with this particular thing. By using examples. Okay, so one example that I like to think about is like you're at the final boss, right? Your hero has discovered the power of friendship and unlocked the super powerful beam or whatever friendship beam to defeat the three-headed dragon or whatever it is.
Tell me more about this.
Maybe in the future I'll come up with more details. So basically all you got to do is charge up this beam. But in the while you're doing that, there's like a bunch of obstacles you need to dodge in order to do that. And while you're trying to you're dodging all these obstacles and like the music is swelling because like this is the big climactic moment, right? You've done all of this work, you've gotten to this point, you're about to defeat the dragon and save the world. And then you get hit by a meteorite and you die and it says game over because you messed up.
Uh-huh.
It feels bad because you got a game over and it's supposed to feel bad. But I also think that it like really like cuts at the knees at the narrative, like that moment.
Yeah.
It breaks it.
Like, I mean, even if you then go back to try again.
Right.
You're like, no, I don't like it.
Yeah. You didn't actually like it doesn't feel like you actually had that climactic moment. It feels like the game is giving you the climactic moment.
This isn't what really happened. What really happened is that you were good enough to get the good ending.
Yeah.
I think that's the test of skill versus narrative satisfaction. I think those things are pulling at each other in a way that I think is what's causing this.
I'd almost prefer it if like if you get hit by the meteorite, you take some damage or whatever, but the game doesn't allow you to die until you shoot the beam and defeat the three-headed dragon. This is too detailed. I don't know why.
And then it gives you permission to die.
Yeah. But I think I'd almost prefer that where the game doesn't even allow you to fail and you just are able, you just do it because you've earned that.
This was a, what's that French guy that made all those games? Detroit Become Human.
Oh, gosh.
And better ones.
Yeah.
anyway, his star has fallen, but that was a thing about those games, is that there was no failure state.
Yeah.
It just progressed.
Right.
And it was actually hard when you play those games to understand when you had triggered what would normally be a game over.
Yeah.
Until you realize that, oh, the story's bending over backwards to make this work.
Yeah.
Because I failed that one thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't always successful, sure. But I think that was an attempt at something like that, to be like, we'll test you once, but like, we don't care if you succeed or not. We're just going to progress anyway.
Yeah.
But you do. And what you give up in that is the video game part.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I brought that up. I'm looking at my notes now. I took a lot of notes.
Yeah.
Mark was commenting on that.
Folks, Steven does not normally take a ton of notes. He's usually got like a really efficient outline.
Yeah.
And then like can really make that work. And here he's like, I've got thoughts.
It's because I didn't have complete thoughts and I wanted to be thorough. Yeah. But that was one of the things that I recognized, is that like when you, one of the core strengths of video games is that you can try things over and over again, and like, you know, you can play in a safe environment where your failure doesn't mean that much.
Yeah.
And I think that's important in core to video games. Like taking that away is a choice. I don't think it's a bad choice. I think it's just, you know, it changes how the game works. Like you're saying, it very dramatically changes how the game works in a way that can be problematic in certain cases. I'm assuming in Detroit Become Human it was problematic, but just because I don't like that game. But I think that it's an avenue in which that would make this maybe feel better for me, but I don't know that it's a choice that like I don't know that it's a good choice in most cases. Mm-hmm. But that is the direction that I'm like kind of thinking about. Another issue I have with this, I think my plan is just to present a bunch of examples,
uh-huh.
And then listeners and y'all too, mm-hmm. Can like talk about them amongst yourselves.
Yeah, well, I want to hear about this on the Discord too.
Yes,
I
please. Hear
how listeners are reacting to this.
Please let me know if I should just get over myself. I probably should, but I need that guidance. So another example I wanted to bring up is that like I feel like game over is like. If you could just, this sucks because this is part of what games are, but if you could just retry all the time when the game is telling you you're doing something wrong, are you really making choices? Are you really making the decision? Or is the game forcing you into decisions that it allows for? That's a weird philosophical kind of thing, but.
Yeah, that tracks with a choose your own adventure mechanic.
Sure.
Right, and that's what's frustrating about that is like I'm gonna see around what's around this corner.
Yeah.
Oh, death. All right.
Yeah.
You know
what I
mean? You know, there's ways you can hint at the right solution, so that's mm-hmm. not a guarantee in that format.
Right.
But what you're saying is, I need to get to that ledge, and I need to be able to get a running jump, and I need to time it here, and I need to get over that cactus and time it all that. Those are not choices I'm making.
Yeah.
Those are like I know what I need to do.
Yes.
And so I need the practice after failing a couple of times. So I don't know that that's the same thing.
I think that's a good point of clarification, because that's a different thing than what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like if you're playing Super Meat Boy, and you don't make the jump, like and you fail from that, like Super Meat Boy's whole core loop, that's like the way the game works, is you need to fail a bunch so that you can figure out how to get through this thing.
Yeah. In games like that, I never feel, and this might be because you don't like puzzle games, but like, Baba's used another example where it's like, there are a couple of, I mean, maybe a lot of levels that have multiple solutions, but for this sake of argument, let's say there's one solution to these puzzles. The trying over and over again is getting to what the right choice is.
Yes.
You are not really ever making those choices.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's
okay with me.
That's fine too.
Yeah.
Also, I will say, I know that like it's kind of a thing on the show. I actually do like puzzle games, but I just like I get frustrated with them up until I find the solution. Then I'm like, I did the thing, and that's the satisfying thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not the
puzzle. So you really like puzzle games, is what I'm hearing.
I do. I guess. But yeah, that's not. I guess that's not what I'm talking about either.
Okay.
I think I'm talking about like. I guess I'm talking about like in Skyrim or something where like you can choose suboptimal decisions. You would want to, if you want to play optimally, you'll get the biggest sword or the best magic ability or what have you. But if you just want to be like a weird, sneaky dagger thief person, and that's not, let's say that's not a very good strategy in Skyrim, the game like will oftentimes like punish that decision. It'll make you fail a bunch of times, because the game decided that like daggers are weaker than other things for some reason. I don't know. Like it's just like really vague and not fully fleshed out.
Do you want a game to respect your choices more then? Is that kind of what you're asking for?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I do. I think I want games to, yeah, I think I would ideally like games to like respect decisions that I made in ways that like, I don't know, in ways that are like meaningful.
Yeah, more with respect ways to that. To tackle this challenge.
Or more ways to where failure is more meaningful than just like learning that this was wrong.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's kind of what I'm looking for. That's so vague, right? I don't know. I'm not, it's not like I have the solution for this or anything like
that. Ellen, how vague is that?
Good question.
Well, it's interesting because I think, I just think about it from a different angle.
Okay.
Like what you're talking about to me is feedback.
Yeah.
And games are full of feedback, right? Like failure, game over is just one way that the game provides feedback to the player about how the game works and what they can expect.
Yeah.
In order to hone the player's like intuition about the system. So, you know, points are feedback. The physics of, you know, jumping around and swinging and something independent, you know, in like a Zelda game, that's feedback. Like you move the controller, something happens on screen, that's feedback.
Right.
And then the things that you get like to reinforce certain actions, like help your brain learn what works and what doesn't. So to me, like what you're asking about to me is that you, I don't know, like, I feel like maybe I don't understand. Maybe there's something about the finality of the game over that you want to have more options to. Like, well, I mean, here's a good example. Like, and this is something that you guys kind of did with Vengeance, right? Like you put a ton of feedback when you were done with a run.
Yeah.
There was a ton of feedback in that.
Right.
It wasn't just a you're done or like, you know, you failed. It was like you failed and here are the numbers.
Yeah. This is why you failed.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Right. Right. And I think that maybe that's a good example. Like something that you made is a good example of why, like what you're actually looking for. It's not just about like you failed, try again, but like really give people some things to think about when they're reloading and trying again.
Yeah. That does help. I guess, yeah, like, yeah, roguelikes are built around this whole thing. You're supposed to fail because, like, that's the core loop. And, you know, Vengeance is built around that idea, just like other roguelikes are. And so, like, I guess that, to me, kind of does make sense in that, like, well, it to me, that kind of feels more like the Super Meat Boy example in that, like, you're supposed to, all of that information that we give the player after you lose in a Vengeance run is so that they understand why this didn't particularly work, why you took a bunch of damage, you weren't blocking enough damage, or you were taking too much hit, you weren't healing enough, things like that. So we're giving you enough information so that like you can recognize that like, oh, I guess the decisions I made this run didn't make as much sense. Maybe next run I can learn from that. So like I think that's valuable feedback and I think that's helpful, but I mean that Vengeance, that is a game over in Vengeance, right? But I think, yeah, I guess, but like at the same time, it feels like there's an interesting like narrative story around some of what you're experiencing, not just in Vengeance, but in other roguelikes and other games that are kind of like that, where like you're like experiencing, you're like picking all of these, you're picking these decisions and stuff and like you're working together with I'm talking about Vengeance now specifically, I guess, but like you're picking all these things, you upgraded your weapons in this way, working with your team in order to get through this, and it doesn't quite work out, but like you still are struggling together to get this, to get through this. Like that feels like a whole narrative in a way that feels similar to me to Dungeons and Dragons, I guess, where like if you get a party wipe in Dungeons and Dragons, and ideally it's not the first night you played the game, I guess that can happen. You like still have a lot of collective story around this game, even if, you know, you get to level 5 and the dragon beats you up.
And right, you're not a user story, right? It's outside the game itself.
Yeah, it's outside the game itself.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that's like quite the same thing. That might be a separate thing, too.
You know, you've sort of illustrated with Fingence.
Yeah.
One of my problems with roguelikes is that because there is so many correct ways to proceed,
mm-hmm.
and Fingence does a good job of this, which is like it doesn't, there's not, it's balanced enough that like you can kind of, with any one or any combination of characters, you can beat the game. Now, there might be optimal ways to do it,
right?
But I'll never know. And one of the reasons is because the game doesn't really, because it never punishes me, it never guides me away from incorrect behavior.
Yes.
Or incorrect loadouts.
Yes.
Because there are none.
Right.
Then I never am motivated to solve it like a puzzle.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have fun with what I chose.
Yeah.
And I know that when you were developing Fingence, one of the frustrations you had was that your goal was to get people to like optimize, and the four players pick the best combination. Who's best at this? Who's best at that?
Mm.
And I think that there's an inherent difficulty because in order to really do that, you need to be a little bit more brutal with how you punish players.
Yeah,
you do. And you need to give them the feedback that Ellen's talking about.
Yes, yeah.
I don't think Fingence suffers from it, but I think it doesn't do what you wanted it to do. And I think that what you're asking for that kind of user story in the context of game overs,
yep.
is kind of asking for those two things to marry each other in a way that when they are kind of mutually exclusive, at least in a lot of contexts they are.
Mm-hmm.
There's something needs to give, something needs to be sacrificed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's part of why I'm having difficulty talking about this as specifically as I would like, is because like I said, I understand the benefits of game overs, and like in order to remove game overs from the games in general,
mm-hmm.
like that requires a dramatic, huge shift.
Yeah.
In a way that like is ridiculous, and I can't ask people to do that. And I'm not asking people to do that either. Mm-hmm. I guess I wanted to vent my frustrations about it.
Why aren't you asking for a game to do that?
I was going to say you could ask. People don't have to do it.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well,
yeah, there's that too, Ellen. Yeah.
I guess I can literally.
You can put it on them.
Yeah. That's true. Because I feel like it's an issue I have with a lot of games.
Okay.
That I personally have. That's it's like I'm not gonna ask horror games to not be scary for my benefit.
Sure.
That's basically the kind of thing that I feel like I'm experiencing. But I guess I wanted to vent my frustrations because I'm curious if other people are experiencing this too, or if like maybe this is a thing that they sort of understand, and maybe me half talking about what I'm talking about helps them get a better understanding of what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious your thoughts. I really, really, really want to hear about them. So let us know on the Discord or in the feedback form. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, this is one I'm desperate to hear our audience's thoughts on.
Yeah, this went more philosophical than I guess I should have seen this coming.
I kind of want to add a note. It occurs to me, I have the power to just do this without telling you guys, and that would be funny, but I'm going to tell you, and I just want to tell you that I have the urge, and I'm not going to act on it, but I have the urge to add a new, like, new field to the feedback form.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, in what ways is Steven wrong?
and then we can count the ways.
Yeah, we can. honestly, we should do that. I'm not going, like, that'd be fun.
I mean, one of the original pitches for the feedback form is tell Steven he's wrong.
Yeah.
So it fits right in.
Now is your opportunity.
Return to form.
Yeah. So nicegames.club/feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you want to have more of a dialogue, nicegames.club/discord.
Yes.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. To tell Steven he's wrong, go to nicegames.club/feedback. You can also visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and sharing accomplishments unapologetically. Apply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. We are also on Patreon. You can support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. You sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And I also mentioned Discord, but I'll mention it again because it's a cool place to hang out. nicegames.club/discord. Next week, it's a big deal, you guys. We're going to be interviewing Ron Gilbert. Yes, that Ron Gilbert. About the intersection between puzzles and narrative. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Anyway, if she barks during the outro, that'll be an outtake. It'll be hilarious. Lie down. Thank you. Lie down. Good girl. Stay. I'll give you a pepperoni. If you're good.